RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Andrew Hoggard is Minister for Biosecurity, Minister for Food Safety, Associate Minister for Agriculture, and Associate Minister for the Environment. He's an activist MP elected in 2023 and former head of Federated Farmers. And Andrew is coming on RCR this morning to talk about a range of topics across his portfolios, including freshwater farm plans, SNAs, etc. And Andrew, welcome to RCR. Thanks for coming on.
No worries. Good to be here.
Okay, so interesting, your former role and your role now. Obviously, the former role well informs what you're doing now. How have you found that kind of transition to the political, the full-on political world now in this area?
Yeah, it's been interesting. I mean, like the issues for me, I'm sort of discussing the same things I've sort of been discussing for the last 18 years. Fair to say now, I don't feel like I'm banging my head against a brick wall when I'm discussing them, because right. I get to make the shots or call the shots. So it's good to be able to sort of affect the change that I've been arguing for quite a while. So in that regard, yeah, it's pretty good. I guess the biggest challenge for me has been a lifelong dairy farmer, very sort of set into my system of waking up at ridiculously early hours of the morning. Parliament sits till 10 p.m. at night, which really has played havoc with my sleep patterns.
So you want to get up in the morning and go milk something still?
Yeah, well, I still wake up at 4:30-ish, 5 o'clock, and check in back on the farm as to what's happening and offer some advice if things aren't working correctly, and then try and get a bit more sleep.
We've talked to quite a few farmers and some Federated Farmers folk on this program already here at RCR. One thing that comes through is that they've felt that farming has been under attack. Is that fair enough?
I definitely think so. Over the last 6 years, that was the feeling for, you know, a lot of farmers. And for those last 6 years of my time in Feds, I was the economics spokesperson as well as being vice president and then president. And so I always had to do the press on our banking confidence survey and our farmer confidence survey. And the whole time I was doing it was pretty much just a one-way, you know, journey of that confidence dropping and dropping, because people were so frustrated with the direction that the rules and regulations were going in and the impact that they were having on farmers. And, you know, and we had some pretty good economic times over that, with commodity prices being pretty good. But people could see all the regulation and the rules weren't going to provide for a future in the path it was going. So, yeah, I can truly understand why people felt under attack. And many times I was sort of feeling it myself of, geez, give us a break here, please.
So there was too much of a focus on what? Climate? Is that fair to say? And not enough focus on knowing where our money, our earning comes from.
Yeah, I think it was just a whole range of factors. So there was, you know, it just seemed like the government had, or the previous government had in its mind that they were the marketers in chief of all New Zealand agricultural exports, and they knew what the customer wanted and how we should all farm to achieve that. And they just never grasped basic economic reality that if a customer truly wants something, then they'll be willing to pay more money for it, and the producer will gladly make those if the extra money they're offering is worth the producer's time, then the producer will make those changes. They just felt that, because I guess effectively they were people who didn't believe in how markets worked, they decided they had to interfere in them. And to me, it was, you know, if there's a market demand, the producer will meet it. Just leave this law of supply and demand to do its thing.
How far did that set us back, do you think?
Oh, look, I think in terms of the confidence, meaning that people weren't investing, a good couple of years, I feel anyway, because when that confidence is dropping, it affects people in terms of wanting to make investments in the next things that will drive improved productivity on their farms. And so, you know, if you don't have confidence, so For example, I've got another 5 years before I have to renew the effluent consent on my farm. Now, if there hadn't been a change of government and they were pushing on with all these plans and programs that they've got and all of the stuff they'd have around the National Policy Statement on Freshwater and all the rest of it, I'd be pretty dubious as to whether or not I would be able to get that effluent consent. Mm. And, you know, should I be investing a whole heap of money, sinking capital into fixing up the milking shed or investing in the latest technology, am I better just to, you know, stop spending effectively,
and run out the clock,
money out of the system, and just go bunker mentality, as I like to call it. That's the sort of impact when you don't have confidence that you've got a future. And we were seeing it in regional council areas where they were giving ridiculously short consents, and farmers are trying to go to banks and say, you know, can I have a 25-year loan to do this investment and that investment? And the bank's going, well, you've only got a guarantee of 5 to 10 years with this consent that you can keep on farming. We can't afford to back that.
Gee, gosh. All right, let's get on to some of the issues. Freshwater farm plans. Government has paused the rollout of freshwater farm plans to address concerns about the system's cost and practicality. So was that always in your mind that the pause button should be hit, and now it has?
Pretty much, yeah. There was always going to be a point in time where, because, I mean, this got introduced by the previous government, this system, and we intended to make changes to it because it was quite costly and there was a whole layer of bureaucracy involved that, quite frankly, I don't think needed to be involved, and also quite a lot of duplication because a lot of farmers already have farm plans that have environmental components to them through their processes or industry programs. And so we were, in effect, having a duplication effect here. And so we were going to make these changes, but it was always going to be a case of we haven't, by now, if the previous government had have still been around, effectively these would have been turned on all over the country. We haven't turned any more on, and what we're doing now is pausing the ones that had been turned on until we've got this program of work done correctly, and these plans are a hell of a lot more sensible and practical and affordable for farmers. They are, freshwater farm plans are a good idea in terms of giving a direction for farmers as to what are the important things that they can do on their farm that'll have good impact on improving water quality, very much targeted on their farm and on their catchment rather than the sort of one-size-fits-all approach from Wellington. And also they're essentially a very good mechanism for removing the need for other regulations. So if you've got a farm plan that details how you're going to work through, you know, manage winter grazing, how you're going to manage, you know, rebuilding culverts and other things like that, then you don't need all these other consents. You know, it's all sort of wrapped up into one. So that's the place we want to get to, that, you know, removing that duplication that frustrates a hell of a lot of farmers.
There's only so much that can be done, though, isn't there? I mean, the very nature of the activity is going to produce, you mentioned effluent, but, you know, it's, and water is essential to the process. It's never going to be perfect, is it?
No, you're never going to have perfection. There will always be a element of, what's the word? I've forgotten it now, an economic term. But there's always going to be an impact. But you've got a human existence, cities, everything, our modern lifestyle has an impact, and we make that trade-off because we need to, because we don't want to go back to a population of just a few million living in caves, even though the Green Party might be quite keen on that idea. Mm-hmm. And so, but, you know, the work that's been done where they've done these farm plans at a catchment level, they have seen, you know, a stepped reduction in pollutants coming from farming systems into the environment. And another piece of work that's been done in a number of catchments is where they've put in, you know, sort of engineered wetlands and detainment bunds and other sort of you know, it's not forcing every single farmer to do something, but looked at it from a catchment point of view as to what are a few sort of engineering things that we could do at this catchment in certain places that are going to have, you know, a big impact. And certainly some of the examples of engineered wetlands that I've seen, they're looking at being able to remove, you know, somewhere from 50 to 80% of the various contaminants from that catchment. And, you know, you've got to have a certain site. I think it's like 1.5 to 2% of the area of the catchment. If that was in a wetland, then you could get up to 90% removal. Now, you may not always be able to do that amount, but still, even being able to get, you know, up to 50% reduction on top of each farmer doing...
Well, this is quite significant. It's huge, yeah. Isn't it, really,
yeah.
Compared to the...
So this is the smart, and this is the sort of stuff I'd rather see being done, catchment level, working with farmers, coming up with pragmatic, you know, targeted actions at that catchment level, at that farm level, rather than forcing, you know, sort of ridiculous reductions that every single farmer has to make, which in effect would probably send everyone broke.
Yeah, they like to control people. What sort of reaction have you had, Andrew, from farmers?
By and large, yeah, pretty positive. You know, no one was particularly looking forward to the idea of having to do a second farm plan. You know, wherever I went to, whether it was horticultural growers, dairy farmers, sheep and beef farmers, you know, they're all, you know, God damn it, we're already inputting, giving government all this much information already, you know, sometimes multiple times. Why are we having to do this again? So removing that duplication is something that is certainly quite keen for a lot of farmers, this one in particular as well, because I really always hate doing a job twice. My motto is do it once, do it right. And so, yeah, everyone's pretty positive about that. And, you know, being able to utilise the existing plans that are already there rather than having to pay, you know, some eye-watering numbers for a second plan. Definitely that's where everyone is quite happy to be going.
Want to get on to SNAs now. The government, it's another pause, right? The scope of a review has been outlined, reconsidering how SNAs, significant natural areas, are identified, assessed and managed. And that follows the introduction of a bill in May that proposed pausing the requirement for councils to identify new SNAs.
Yeah.
What is your personal feeling, I guess, but that will move into, I guess, your political feeling on SNAs? Is there a place for them?
In a rare situation, personally, I think, you know, there might, you know, if there is only this amount of habitat left in this region, then there might, you know, you'd say, okay, well, we need to protect this. But how we've seen it used is basically, you know, the West Coast is a perfect example. You know, 80% of it, more than 80% is in dock controlled land. You've got huge amounts of all of this biodiversity already that exists there. Grabbing an extra 10, 20 hectares off some farmers, to me, makes no sense. And, you know, my view is I'd much rather work, like the work I'd rather be doing, well, I am doing this work as well, is on biodiversity credits. And supposedly there's this huge demand worldwide from companies that want to invest rather than in carbon credits. They want to invest in biodiversity credits because they see that as, I don't know, a little less of the greenwashing that carbon credits can be seen as. And so I want to put that system in place so that, you know, the farmers that have got the biodiversity on their farms are actually rewarded rather than having their property rights taken off them. That's my preferred approach to it. And so we're basically tightening up the definition of these SNAs so that they are only where it's truly, truly significant, but also trying to put in place this biodiversity credit system, which is more of the carrot, and, you know, let's go down that approach rather than taking people's property rights off them. That's sort of where the direction of travel is.
biodiversity credits, though, would have to have the same value, similar or even a little more than the productive land that might be caught up in that has. Wouldn't it to make sense to a farmer?
Well, no, because to be fair, if you think about it, we've got the QE2 Trust all up and down New Zealand where farmers have put covenants on biodiversity that's on their farms. You know, they haven't needed a council to tell them that it's important. They've made that decision themselves. Now, if you put all those QE2 covenants together, they would make our fifth largest national park. Huh? And that's the scale of what farmers have already done without needing a bureaucrat to tell them to do it. And so I don't actually think there is a problem with farmers wanting to look after biodiversity. I think farmers are willing to do it. You know, I've got 20 hectares on my place that's regenerating, and well, there's a bit of remnant forest there and other bits of it are regenerating. And, you know, it doesn't make a lot of sense to farm it, and I'm pretty happy with it staying there like it is. And, you know, if those credits were in place, then I could probably, you know, take some of that return from them to invest back in improving what is there already. So I think that's the approach that we're much more wanting to take.
Is there potential to use SNAs in a vexatious way? Like, we don't like you, so we're going to slap an SNA on your property, teach you a lesson.
Well, I think we saw that, I think it was with the, I can't remember whether it was with the Wellington Regional Council or the Wellington, I think it was Wellington Regional Council. There was a case about 4 or 5 months back where basically can't remember whether it was an SNA or wetland rules, but they basically took a landowner to court. In fact, he ended up in prison, and then the council, because, you know, basically he butted heads with the council inspector, and the council in the end on appeal you know, had to pay quite a bit of compensation to this guy. So there are examples where, you know, and I think it's not even vexatious, it's often just lazy in terms right. of the mapping of these things. They just, you've seen it with the Gore District Council, you know, they're trying to mapping out the sites that are significant to Māori. Well, they're just
going to
blanket plaster the whole district rather than go, well, here's a special archaeological site that we have to recognise. They've just gone and said the whole place, and that's created all sorts of uncertainty and headache for landowners down.
Yeah, they've been flying over areas, just mapping them, putting them on a computer and just kind of drawing arbitrary boundaries from that. That we talked to a few people, I think it was a Northland farmer, who had aerial surveillance or aerial analysis of the area around him, and on a computer they'd just kind of drawn arbitrary boundaries, and that and that is how that was determined for him. And he said they never came and saw me, and they never actually looked at the place. And I want to talk about for SANS now, seeking submissions on definitions for gene technology and new breeding techniques. Proposal to amend the definitions in the Australian New Zealand Food Standards Code for food product using gene technology, and that includes gene editing technology. Foods that they judge through various technical criteria are substantially equivalent to natural foods might no longer be labelled as such or even referred to as genetically modified. This concerns our listeners, Andrew.
So how the FSANS system works is they will consult on things, and then it'll come back to the board, and then it'll be referred to the minister. So this hasn't actually landed on my desk yet.
Right.
But in terms of, I would say, the gene editing side of it, you know, with gene editing, you can have various levels. And the thing is, you can gene edit to basically speed up natural breeding. So my favourite example is having polled cattle. So polled means they don't naturally have horns. Now, that can naturally occur, or you could gene edit the animal or the embryo so that it has that trait within it. Now, that's still a cow. That's still, it could happen naturally. I could breed to a polled animal to have a 50-50 chance of getting a polled calf out of it. Here's just a more certain way of achieving it. Now, you've got the potential where that would be, oh, is that milk genetically modified that was coming from that cow? I would argue it's no different to if I had have done that naturally. So there's various levels. At this stage, I haven't seen any of the feedback or anything on this yet. So it's pretty early days, and I guess we'll be waiting to see what the consultation throws up and what the feedback throws up and what the recommendations are. But it hasn't hit a ministerial level yet.
Okay. But the example you just gave, I get what you say.
Hmm.
But in terms of being fully informed as a consumer,
yeah,
maybe what you just told me, okay, I can take that on board or have some other sort of reaction. But I'd probably want to know before I made my choice. Is that fair enough?
Yeah, look, I think, so my understanding at the moment is there is a requirement currently that if something is, so there is a whole bunch of genetically modified food that's out there that you can purchase, but it does need to be labelled that. Mm. I get where I'm, so labelling seems to be quite a big thing in the food safety side of the job, and I really do sit on the side that you should be able to put on the label what's factual statements, and and I do think there is probably there's an element of the public that will undoubtedly not want to buy GMO food, and so I personally would think having that labelling there is needed for them to give them confidence in the food they're buying. I think where it's going to get tricky as the science evolves is that definition of what is, you know, when everyone thinks about genetic modification, they're thinking of, you know, the frog genes and the tomatoes type scenario, as opposed to that single gene edit slice thing where it could be achieved naturally or you could speed it up using gene editing. And so I think at some, you know, we probably are going to need to get to a point and decide. I would think with the gene editing, it would be vastly more costly to go down a route of, for example, that example I just gave of trying to differentiate the milk supply across all of Fonterra of who has used a gene editing for old cattle as opposed to who hasn't. And it may be for that sort of thing that those customers will want to just go, okay, if I purchase from this organic brand that states it's non-GMO or non-gene editing, is that the way the customer gets confidence?
Yeah, so a more specialized product rather than the general product that which is labeled. Would you make an assumption?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's definitely a risk as gene editing becomes more prevalent going forward. There is a risk of creating quite a complex and costly system of verification that will get passed on to consumers in terms of the price. And so for those that want assurances around the fact that there is no GMO or no gene editing, you know, it's having those specialized products that they can buy. And so there's the systems in place that they can be sure that there's no gene editing or whatever it is, the label claims they like, whereas everyone that just wants to buy the cheapest and is not too worried about this stuff, you know,
it's not labeled and they just assume that they're just taking whatever for sands is. All right.
I mean, I haven't seen anything of where this is at the moment. So,
fair enough.
Yeah, this is very early days, and those are just my, you know, my gut feel on the subject.
And it's good to hear them. I'm also wondering, and you'll know this because of your history, that we have a certain perception in the world for our food, the quality of our food, and that includes, you know, dairy and all of that. We're going to have to be careful, even if you can make that argument or raise that point you did before about the cattle and the horns. and whether genetic editing is just a speed up of a natural process, there's still perceptions attached to it. And we have to be careful. Do you think we have to be, you know, really careful about how we're perceived? That's the other thing.
Well, I mean, the funny thing is everyone talks about how it might impact in us in some of these more advanced markets and the more, you know, likes of Europe and America. Mm. Well, our rules are vastly more stricter than in either of those places. And to me, it's about, you know, not interfering in the market. So if there is a market demand for GE, then, or GE-free, sorry, and Fonterra sees this and they say, well, look, this is way more valuable than the cost reductions that might come from doing some gene editing on various aspects, they will say, okay, look, everyone that's supplying us, we don't want you to use this. We're making more money this way. And so, you know, law of supply and demand. We will go where the value is. And there will be some companies that will go, actually, there's a niche GE-free option for us here in these markets. We've got a small number of suppliers. We can do this. I think the best value comes to farmers when governments get out of the way and let markets work. And so that's where I just think the important thing will be ensuring that from a food safety perspective or a marketing perspective, that customers can have faith in the label that's on the market, on the product. So if the label says GMO free, then everyone has faith in the fact that this is GMO free. The systems are robust around that. But you've got GMO-free products that are produced in the United States alongside conventional. So we can do both. It's not a situation of we can only do one thing in New Zealand. Some of us can do GMO, some of us can do organic.
All right. Andrew Hoggard, Minister for Biosecurity, Food Safety, Associate Minister of Agriculture, Associate Minister for the Environment. Thanks for coming on, Andrew.
No worries. Thank you very much.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.